thought his name would be Mudson. He pulled off a miracle on the Hudson. Everybody's talking about Sully, Sully. Everybody's talking about Sully. He's on everyone's mind because he's one of a kind. And the way he lands a plane is mighty fine.
Get ready to land whatever plane you're flying in the Hudson River because you're listening to Film Bookcast and we're about to crash into your engine. Look out!
Wow. That got really – I wasn't prepared at all for any of that.
Film Bookcast is the official podcast of filmbook.com. My name is Mike Smith, and joining me as always is a man who always decides to keep filming because the people deserve to know.
Mike DiCrescia.
How you doing today, Mike?
Good. I'm just trying to do my part to get the truth out there, Mike.
Right. You've seen a lot of horrifying stuff in your day, but you always keep the camera rolling because the people need to know what you saw on that day.
That's right. I could drop the camera and run for my life, right. But I suppress that.
Yes, suppress that urge for the benefit of us. Yeah. If you've never listened to Film Bookcast before, first we start with some film news, and then we move on to some discussions where Mike and I each discuss whatever media we've been consuming lately, and then after that, we'll move on to our featured review. This week, we are reviewing the new film from director Adam Wingard, Blair Witch. You excited, Mike?
I am. We got a lot to do today.
We do have a lot to do today, so let's get right into it, Mike. It's time for film news. It's time for some film news, and we've got a lot to get through, so we'll try to get through it as quickly as possible. But let's get into some director news, Mike. Some news about some high-profile movie directors who are working on new projects, the first of which is Paul Thomas Anderson, director of films like Magnolia and Punch Drunk Love and There Will Be Blood and Inherent Vice and a lot of the best films in the last, like, 20 years or so. He is going to be re-teaming with his There Will Be Blood star Daniel Day-Lewis for a new film about the London fashion industry in the 1950s.
As like unexciting as that plot, whatever that is, I'm in because Paul Thomas Anderson and Daniel Day-Lewis.
Yeah, one of the best directors of the last 20 years, one of the best actors probably of all time.
Yeah. Two people, six names, what could go wrong?
Yeah, who previously worked together on There Will Be Blood, which is a masterpiece. That movie's incredible.
Yeah.
And this movie's coming out next year, 2017, so we have that to look forward to very soon, hopefully. That's pretty cool. So I wanted to mention that. And then also, this is weird. We talked about this off the air last time we recorded an episode. Last time we were talking about Gravity. We were talking about Alfonso Cuarón and being like, oh, it's been a couple years since Gravity. When's Alfonso Cuarón going to be working on his next project? Because his son is coming out with a new movie that you saw a trailer for. I forget the name of it.
Desierto.
Desierto, that's the one. Well, now, Alfonso Cuarón has announced his next project, and he's returning to Mexico. He's going to be doing another mid-budget Spanish-language film, which he hasn't done in a while, and it's about a middle-class Mexican family living in Mexico City.
Perfect. I'm in.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. He's been doing, a lot of big-budget, high-effects movies over his last few. I mean, Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban, Children of Men, and then Gravity.
Right.
So this is going back to his like Itumama Tambien days, which is pretty neat. You know, it's a kind of a return to form for him. And I'm definitely interested in it because I liked Gravity, but I didn't like love it. I felt like it was kind of like the filmmaking was incredible, but I felt like it was kind of thin on a story level and a screenplay level. So I'll be interested to see how this one plays out if it plays out more like his older films.
Yeah, I'm interested. I mean, it's funny that like all these people are talking about these three directors. They're like, kind of whatever they make, I want to see. So
exactly, that's kind of the thing. So Paul Thomas Anderson's working on a new movie. Alfonso Cuarón's working on a new movie. Done. I'm in. And then finally, Spike Lee is going to be directing every episode of a new Netflix series based on his film She's Gotta Have It, which is pretty wild. I have not seen She's Gotta Have It. I'll be upfront with that. But Spike Lee's a great director who's had kind of a hit or miss career over the last several years or so, but he usually makes stuff that's interesting at least.
Yeah.
And I think this shows just how big of a draw Netflix is, where they can get like big name directors like Spike Lee and auteur directors to really just commit to a Netflix series. You know, like they just had Baz Luhrmann directing The Get Down.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Which I have not watched that either. I've heard very good things.
I was hearing a lot of things about how it got overshadowed because it came out the same time as Stranger Things.
Yeah, it was like a week later. And it's also, I'm surprised. I don't think Netflix anticipated how big of a hit Stranger Things would be.
Right.
Because that show took off like wildfire, and they should have Just the subject matter of that show seems tailor-made for the internet.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
But The Get Down is also Netflix's most expensive show, so I think they really wanted that to be a bigger hit. And I think it has done okay for itself, but it costs like $150 million or something.
What?
Yeah.
Wow. That's crazy.
Yeah, so I think Netflix definitely wants that show to be bigger than it is right now, because, I mean, Stranger Things is blowing up. Like, Stranger Things is huge now. I mean, that show is a cultural phenomenon. Incidentally, I finished Stranger Things recently, and I thought it was fine.
Oh, Mike.
I am the wet blanket in the Stranger Things world.
Yes, you are.
I enjoyed aspects of it. There was stuff I certainly liked, but I felt like it mostly just felt like, man, I really wish I was watching E.T. or something. You know?
Yeah, I guess that's fair.
But in any case, those are the three directors who are moving on to new projects, which is pretty cool. These are big name directors doing interesting stuff, so that's pretty cool. Also, I wanted to bring this up. Jackie Chan and Owen Wilson, the dynamic duo, if you will, are reuniting for Shanghai Dawn, which is, of course, the sequel to Shanghai Nights and Shanghai Noon. I don't remember which one came first. Was Shanghai Noon first or Shanghai Nights?
I think Noon was first and then Nights.
Okay. Have you seen either of those movies, Mike?
I have seen both of them.
Okay. I've actually not seen them.
Really?
Yeah, but I am a big fan of Jackie Chan, and I like Owen Wilson, too. Jackie Chan hasn't been in an American movie in a very long time.
Yeah, I don't remember what the last one was, but
I believe it was the Karate Kid remake, which was back in 2010, so it's been a while since Jackie Chan has been in a movie. Is Shanghai Dawn something that you want to see?
Maybe? It seems really funny. I mean, those movies are very much like the late 90s, early 2000s action comedy, so like Rush Hour, like those type of movies.
Right.
And what was the one with, oh man, Eddie Murphy and Robert De Niro?
They're, whatever. 48 Hours?
No, when they're filming like a police reality show and Eddie Murphy is the host. And it's another one of those silly buddy action comedy movies. So it'll be cool to see, I guess. I just assume it'll be more of the same stuff. Except now they'll make jokes about that they're old. So
that's how action franchises go, is they're big for a while, and then suddenly the actors are old, but they still make them, so they have to make jokes about how they're old.
Yeah, exactly. It'll be the funnier version of The Expendables, probably.
Okay, that'd be interesting if they can get like other 90s action comedy stars in there.
Yeah. And the other thing, too, it'll be interesting to see, I guess, you know, the whole shtick of those of the first two movies is that they're, you know, take place in the Wild West, the first one,
right,
and then the next one, I forget, it's in England, okay. But you know, it's those, like, it's 1910s 1920s era, so it'll be interesting to see where they go from there. I mean, I guess I don't know what era they'll pick for the third one.
I mean, it would have to, I guess it would be like 10 or 20 years later, however long it's been, so
maybe, yeah,
1940s or
something like that. Which I don't know if so cool we get a World War II action comedy, I guess. I don't know.
That'd be something. Maybe. This one's going to be directed by Jared Hess, who directed Napoleon Dynamite. He also directed Nacho Libre. So, I mean, do you feel like he is a good fit for these Shanghai movies? Because, again, I haven't seen them, so I'm basing this entirely on you.
I guess. I mean, those are straight. Those Nacho Libre and Napoleon Dynamite are more awkward comedy type stuff,
sure,
you know, right, as compared to like Rush Hour, which is just action comedy.
Yeah, well, he's directing Masterminds, which is coming out I think next week, with Zach Galifianakis. I think Owen Wilson's in that too.
Okay, yeah.
So that's more of a heist comedy kind of thing, so it could indicate whether he's a good
work
fit for,
yeah,
whether he's a good fit for this movie. I mean, and nobody knows how that movie's gonna turn out. Yeah, I think it's been sitting on the shelf for a long time.
Okay.
But we'll see what happens. I am hoping for a big Jackie Chan comeback. I think.
Yeah, I think that'll be a huge draw for a lot of people, because, like you said, it's been a long time since he was the star of a movie.
Yeah, I'm hoping he comes back, and like that'd be cool. And I know he's talking about doing a Rush Hour 4 as well, getting Chris Tucker back involved. Which I'm not a big fan of the Rush Hour movies. I've seen all three of those, and I think they're all pretty terrible. But but again, I love Jackie Chan, so you know, who knows?
Yeah.
Maybe we need the Tuxedo 2. Is that that's?
I think that's that, the one.
That's the one. That'll be the Jackie Chan vehicle that gets him to come back.
Yep.
But in any case, so that's happening. And then other news: DC casting news. Joe Manganiello is playing Deathstroke in Ben Affleck's Batman movie. Now, are you familiar with Joe Manganiello, Mike, at all?
I am, but I don't remember why.
Well, I I mostly know him from the Magic Mike movies. He plays one of
I was going to say, I'm pretty sure it's Magic Mike.
Yeah. Yeah, he plays one of Channing Tatum's friends in that movie. And he's one of the highlights of the Magic Mike movies. He's always really fun and really funny in those movies. I think he could actually be pretty good casting for Deathstroke. My main familiarity with Deathstroke, I'm actually fairly familiar with him outside of the comics because he was the villain in the Teen Titans cartoon when I was a kid.
Right.
And he was also the villain in season 2 of Arrow.
Interesting.
Where he was, like, great on Arrow. He was played by Manu Bennett in Arrow. He was kind of recurring in season 1 and then became the villain in season 2. And he was easily the best villain that Arrow has ever had, which is not saying too much because Arrow's not a great show. And its villains are usually pretty weak. But but Deathstroke was very, very good on that show.
Hot take.
I don't know if it's that hot a take. But in any case, Deathstroke's a cool choice for a Batman villain. He's not been used in any movies yet.
Yeah, I'm not particularly familiar with Deathstroke. Other than that, I think he's just like Deadshot, but maybe not.
Kind of. He's basically an assassin.
Yeah. You know? Okay.
Which is all you really need to know. He's cool. He's got a cool mask.
Yeah, I know his costume, and that's pretty cool. Yeah. So.
But he hasn't been used as a villain yet, so I think that'll be interesting. I've heard stories that Ben Affleck's Batman would have kind of cameos from like all of Batman's villains. Like it would almost be like a Batman Arkham Asylum video game adaptation.
Okay.
Which that could be cool. Like
that could be really cool.
That
yeah.
could be very cool. I would hope that Jared Leto's Joker is not in it, but otherwise.
Yep. Which is what I was just going to say. It'll be really interesting to see a Batman movie with some of the maybe lesser known or more B-team villains rather than Bane and the Joker, Penguin or something like that we've seen a million times.
Yeah, we've seen the Penguin a bunch. We've seen the Riddler before. We've seen Two-Face a few times. Like, you know, give us something we haven't seen before, you know?
Yeah.
That's what we want out of Batman. Ben Affleck, if you're listening, which you probably are. Realistically, come on, man.
Yeah, so I think it'll be interesting to see if you know, it's kind of what we have to talk about every time a DC movie comes out. Of will this be the one that is good finally? and I feel like I'm pretty confident in Ben Affleck as a director and as Batman. I think he can do it.
Yeah, Ben Affleck's a solid director. He's got a new movie coming out called Live by Night, which looks very good that he directed. That's a movie set in a Prohibition era Boston, which of course it's in Boston.
Of course it is. Yeah,
but you know, Ben Affleck doing a Prohibition era gangster movie, like okay, I can get in on that.
Yeah,
you know, why not? But it has to be Boston, of course.
But
it looks pretty cool, and then he's going to be doing this Batman movie. But, you know, before we even get to that, we really got to focus on whatever's coming next, which is Wonder Woman,
right.
Which does look pretty cool. But, you know, we've been saying this looks pretty cool for the last three DC movies, and they haven't worked out for us. So.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen much about Wonder Woman other than the trailer I saw before Suicide Squad. So.
Right. Yeah, but I'm basing my stuff on the trailer too. I think the trailer looked fun. It looked cool. It looked different than the other movies.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping they just gave Patty Jenkins free reign to do whatever she wants.
Yeah, I think that'll be the way to end the issues with the DC movies.
Yeah, just let their filmmakers do their thing. Which, to be fair, is what they did with Zack Snyder, and that didn't work out. But you know, not everybody's Zack Snyder. You know.
That's true, but like, we are just living in his universe.
We are all living in Zack Snyder's universe. It's the Snyderverse, and we're all just living in it. And you know who else is living in the Snyderverse, Mike?
Who's that?
The Emmy winners.
Nice segue.
Boom. So the Emmys were this past weekend. Mike, did you watch them?
I did not.
Well, I did.
I knew I could count on you.
Yeah, I watch the Emmys every year. This year's show was fine. All the winners were like really actually very good. It was a wide variety of different shows that won things, and they were mostly all pretty critically acclaimed shows. And even if I don't watch all of them, there are all shows that I've heard are very good or I want to watch. They look interesting, at least. The show itself, Jimmy Kimmel was the host, and I'm not a big fan of him. I thought he did fine. He had some solid jokes in there. There was actually one very funny moment where it came back from commercial, and the announcer. Announces who's going to be presenting the next award, and it says, like, please welcome four-time Emmy winner Dr. Bill Cosby. And you see the entire crowd kind of going like, what? Like, what? And you see, especially like it cuts to like Tina Fey and Amy Poehler, and they're like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, you can't be serious.
Yeah.
And then like, there's like silence for a minute, and then Jimmy Kimmel walks out and it's like, he's not really here. I just wanted to see what you guys would do.
That's amazing.
So that was pretty good. And there's some solid jokes in there, but mostly Kimmel was fine. He did, you know, the standard kind of Emmy opening where he's just going through a bunch of different shows, and, you know, other hosts have done that better in the past. It wasn't nearly as good as last year when Andy Samberg hosted.
Right.
And he hosted with a show that was written by the Comedy Bang Bang Writers Room.
Yep, written just for you, Mike.
The Emmys written for Mike. It was amazing. I highly recommend watching the 2015 Emmys if you get around to it. If they're available anywhere, I don't know.
I don't know how that works.
But you can watch clips of them on YouTube. I was actually watching Andy Samberg's opening segment earlier today. It's good stuff. But I wanted to talk about the Emmy winners, just to say who won. The People vs. O.J. Simpson was the big winner. I think they won like 5 awards. They basically swept the miniseries category, which is what they're counted as. Fargo was also included in the miniseries category. Which means it lost a lot of awards.
Yeah, that's unfortunate.
Unfortunate, but The People vs. O.J. Simpson was a great show, though, which I would not have predicted, you know, earlier in the year. But there you go. So Sarah Paulson, Courtney B. Vance, and Sterling K. Brown all won awards for that show. Veep won Best Comedy Series, which it won last year, and Game of Thrones won Best Drama Series, which it also won last year. So if you watched the 2015 Emmys, you also kind of saw the 2016 Emmys. And then for the acting awards. The Best Comedy Awards, Julie Louis-Dreyfus won Best Actress for the 5th year in a row, which is insane.
The Bryan Cranston of Comedy Awards.
Basically, yeah. Bryan Cranston only won 3 years in a row.
Wow, really?
Yeah. And then he won again for the show's last season. He won like 4 times non-consecutively. Julie Louis-Dreyfus has won 5 years in a row. Every season that Veep has been on the air, Julie Louis-Dreyfus has won the Emmy. And it's... Part of me thinks, like, maybe they should spread it around, spread the love, give it to somebody else. But at the same time, she's so good on Veep.
Yeah.
like it seems unfair to other actresses.
To even be nominated.
They should just have the Julie Louis-Dreyfus Award, give her an honorary Emmy, and then have a separate award for the other comedy actresses. And then other than her, Jeffrey Tambor won Best Actor. Again, he won last year for Transparent. Kate McKinnon won Best Supporting Actress for Saturday Night Live, which is pretty cool.
Yeah,
because I mean, she definitely deserves it. She's like the breakout first on Saturday Night Live, and she's been having quite a year. She was in Ghostbusters, and then Louis Anderson won Best Supporting Actor for Baskets, which is a show that I watch, but like nobody else does.
Yeah, that was a pretty crazy sentence that you just said.
I know, right? Like, we were watching it. I was watching it with my parents, and my like Louis Anderson walked up on stage, and my dad like looked at me and was like, "I thought he was dead." Like.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, so Louis and that's a show that I was shocked that it was nominated in the first place. That was its only nomination. I was shocked that it was nominated in the first place, and I was even more shocked that it won.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy.
That was pretty cool, and it's totally deserved. He's great on that show. He plays Zach Galifianakis' mom on the show, and he's really good in the role. So there's that. And then the best acting for the drama series... Tatiana Maslany won for Orphan Black, Best Actress, which is long overdue. I don't watch Orphan Black, but a lot of people have been championing for her to win for a long time.
Yeah.
And she plays like 25 different characters on the show or something, because they're all clones.
Something nuts. Yeah.
And from what I understand, every character is like a distinct personality that she sells very well. So that's pretty cool. That's, you know, some, a well-deserved Emmy, I assume.
From what I've heard.
Yeah, and then Rami Malek won for Mr. Robot, which is also a show I don't watch, but again, that show has been pretty big and it's got a lot of critical acclaim. So that was interesting. I was hoping for somebody else. I think I was hoping for Bob Odenkirk, actually, because he was nominated for Better Call Saul, and that would have been neat, but it didn't happen. But and then Ben Mendelsohn from Bloodline won Best Supporting Actor, and Maggie Smith won Best Supporting Actress for Downton Abbey, which is she's won like 3 or 4 times now. And she's never shown up to the ceremony once. She does not care about those awards at all.
Not even a little bit.
And even at the during his opening monologue, Jimmy Kimmel was making fun of that, saying that, you know, like, we always get the Emmy to Maggie Smith, and she's never here to take it. So we're not accepting the award on her behalf. If she wants it, she can come get it.
And then she won.
And then she won. And then they were, like, the person presenting was actually about to say, like, oh, we accept this award on her behalf. And then Jimmy Kimmel actually walked out on stage and took the Emmy away. And was like, no. So that was pretty good. Yeah, overall, solid Emmys. I mean, the awards themselves are going to a wide variety of things, which is pretty cool. I think they changed the voting rules recently. because, you know, for the longest time, they would kind of reward a lot of mediocre shows. You know, right. Modern Family won Best Comedy, I think, 4 or 5 years in a row, which is a show that should not be doing that. there's so much more interesting and edgy comedy going on TV. Like, Modern Family is like the safe choice. Big Bang Theory would also win a lot of awards, too, and stuff like that. Homeland won a bunch of awards, which is still a show that people like, but I mean, it's...
Thanks for your in-depth analysis.
Yeah,
Ben.
I mean, I watched most of the first season of Homeland, and that's supposed to be the show that's supposed to be the season that people like, and then I've heard it goes off the rails after that. But I didn't even like the first season that much, so...
Yep, I had a very similar experience.
Yeah. But that is the Emmys. I wanted to bring those up because they were this past weekend, and we never talked about them when the nominations were announced. So I figured we should talk about them now. And you didn't watch them, so we'll just move on. You know, we don't have to keep talking about the Emmys. But I mean, I'm telling you now, we are going to watch the Oscars. That's going to happen.
All right. Well, that I could expect a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, we did that last year, so.
Exactly.
All right. Let's. That about wraps up film news, Mike. Let's move on into our discussion. Watch this. These are my discussions. Just when I thought I said all I could say, my buddy and I talk about movies we see. These are my discussions. There is so much to see, you and me. So we're going to talk about movies for our discussions. All right, Mike, let's move on to our discussions. What do you have to discuss with us this week?
So this week I'm talking about Hell or High Water. It's a new film directed by David McKenzie, written by Taylor Sheridan, who wrote Sicario, which I believe we were both really big fans of.
You were a really big fan of. I thought it was pretty solid.
Okay, fair enough. We both liked it.
I enjoyed it. There was a lot of good stuff in Sicario to go on with.
Yeah. Starring Ben Foster, Chris Pine, and Jeff Bridges. And it's a pretty slow burn heist movie, basically. Two brothers... robbing banks to raise enough money to save their farm. It's set in Texas, and it's a pretty interesting, like, character study of this family in the, you know, bouts of recession, about to lose their farm to the get foreclosed on, and they turn to crime to save the family. And it takes a long time to get where it's going, I think, or to, you know, sets up a lot of high stakes and then pays off in a really big way. And I loved it. I thought it was really good. It kind of was like a sleeper hit, sort of. I saw a lot of articles like touting it as the sleeper hit of the summer.
Right.
And I think it was awesome. I thought it was good. People should check it out.
Okay.
I think I'm really interested to see where Taylor Sheridan goes after that. After seeing these two movies that I've enjoyed a lot, I hope he writes some more. I don't remember. I had looked up and he had a few movies on his IMDb slated to come out soon or coming out in the next year or two. So it's definitely a person to keep an eye on if you're interested in him.
Cool. Yeah. I also saw Hell or High Water, and I also really dug it. I thought it was really, really good. It's like a modern day Western almost.
Right. Yeah.
In the way that the characters act and behave. I thought Chris Pine in particular, I thought was great. Ben Foster was fantastic. Jeff Bridges, like everybody in this movie is just really, really good.
Yeah.
And it's just it's the kind of thing that, makes you remember why you like movies in the first place, you know?
Right. Yeah.
Cause it seems like it's so like effortlessly good.
Yeah.
You know, in a summer that, has seen a lot of movies that have been very, very bad.
Right. Yeah.
You know, coming off like Suicide Squad and stuff like that. Like it's nice. Yeah. It's nice to have something that's not trying to be super big, super massive. It's a fairly like low stakes thing. I think it's made in a budget of like $12 million.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just a solid, low stakes thing. Only a couple characters doing their thing. I found it really good. It has a really interesting examination of morality in this world. And
It reminded me a lot of Killing Them Softly with Brad Pitt, where it's kind of about that, you know, what lengths would you go to provide kind of thing.
Yes.
And also and to avoid the cliche of the setting was like a character in the movie, but this movie is very much about living in Texas.
Yes.
And about that, the good old boys, which I love when they make fun of them with the, you know, the concealed carry permits and all that stuff.
Yes.
It was great.
Yeah. And also this movie also has a really good sense of humor too, which I liked very much. I felt like, you know, the characters would rap. They never felt like they were like overwritten lines. Like they didn't feel like comedy writer lines or something. They just kind of felt like naturalistic dialogue that happened to be pretty funny.
Yeah,
which I enjoyed very much. So that is Hell or High Water. Both of us really recommend it. And then my discussions, I've got a few things I want to talk about. With the first thing is a movie I saw recently called Sully, which is why...
Never heard of it.
Which is why I made that Sully joke at the beginning and why I played that Sully song at the beginning as well. This is the new film based on Captain Sullenberger, the guy who landed a plane on the Hudson River back in 2009. It's directed by Clint Eastwood and starring Tom Hanks as Sully, and includes Aaron Eckhart, Michael Malley, Anna Gunn, and a few others. And I gotta say, we made a lot of jokes about Sully in the past, Mike. We were preemptively trashing it. Not trashing it, but we were making a lot of jokes about how this movie doesn't really need to happen. You know, there's not that much interesting that you can wring out of this story. But I gotta say, I found myself mostly enjoying the film. I see your, like, skeptic look go back there. Yeah. Look of surprise. Yeah. So this movie actually mostly deals with the aftermath of the crash on the Hudson, which you see the crash throughout the movie. It's kind of repeatedly seen throughout the film in flashbacks, and it's also shown from different perspectives. So it'll show you Sully's perspective during one sequence, and then in a different perspective, you'll see the flight controller who is helping Sully land the plane and that kind of thing. And it has this kind of old-fashioned sensibility that I felt worked very much for this kind of story. And there are problems to be had, for sure, but there are moments that have, like, true visual power, which is then undercut by, like, some really clunky dialogue. there's a moment in this movie during the plane crash where the plane is coming down and it's going... like, very close to New York buildings, and the visual implication, it's supposed to recall 9/11, obviously. Right. And you see it, and it's, like, it's not subtle, but it's very well done, I think. And then later on in the movie, you know, after Sully's landed the plane, somebody's talking to him and been like, and he's like, you know, New Yorkers haven't had that much good luck with planes. Lately, you know what I'm talking about. And it's like, come on, man. We got it.
Yeah, we know what you're talking about.
And, you know, it's the kind of movie that's very light. It's very breezy. It's the kind of movie that it's just in and out in 90 minutes. It's like 91 minutes long. It's the kind of movie where everyone just recognizes Sully as a hero at the end, and then everybody laughs at a joke that somebody makes as it fades to black and the credits roll.
Oh, my God. That's amazing,
but it's nice. It's you know, it's not challenging in any way, but it's a really, I think, enjoyable time, and it does some interesting filmmaking stuff going on. So I did ultimately enjoy Sully. It has problems, but it's a very solid time at the movies. And then there's a few TV shows I wanted to mention. The fall TV season is back in session, right. And there's a bunch of new shows that are coming out. I checked out a couple are made by people who I really like and are making new shows. And the first of which is Atlanta, which is a new FX TV show from Donald Glover. And the other one is Better Things, which is another FX TV show from Pamela Adlon. Really, really digging Atlanta. You know, I'm a big fan of Donald Glover, you know, going back to Community. Right. You know, he was amazing on that show. He's amazing in Mystery Team. And, you know, he's a writer on 30 Rock back in the day. I'm a big fan of his comedy. I'm less of a fan of Childish Gambino, only because... I really like his comedy so much that, like, I wish he would just keep doing that more. So I'm very glad that he's back on TV and he's bringing a unique and fresh perspective to the table. You know, he's a student of both comedy and rap, obviously, with Childish Gambino, right. And he's able to merge both of those sides of his career in this show. And it's really, really great. The cast is very fleshed out and it's just really enjoyable. It's not as jokey as something like Community,
right?
But again, almost like Hell or High Water, the humor comes from just kind of the naturalistic dialogue. That also just happens to be really funny, because Donald Glover's really funny. He sells very well. And the cast around him, Lakeith Stanfield, who played Snoop Dogg in Straight Outta Compton, is a cast member on the show, and he is amazing. He plays Darius. Hilarious. He's really good. Also very much enjoying Better Things, which at the moment is a slice-of-life comedy similar to Louie, which Pamela Adlon is a recurring character on. She's the creator of the show. And Louis C.K. actually produced this show and directed the pilot episode. It's not laugh-out-loud funny yet, but it's enjoyable and it's amusing. And I think it's going to continue to grow into something that could be very special. So I'm going to keep watching both shows, but Atlanta right out the gate I think is really, really strong. And then I also watched The Good Place, which is the new NBC comedy from Michael Schur, who's the creator of Parks and Recreation. Have you seen anything but The Good Place, Mike?
No, I have not.
Okay, I'm going to describe the plot to you, and you're going to be like, how is this airing on a network?
All right.
So this stars Kristen Bell and Ted Danson.
Mm-hmm.
And Kristen Bell plays a woman who dies, and is sent to the Good Place, which is this universe's version of heaven. The twist is that this was a mistake. Kristen Bell was actually a very bad person in her life and does not deserve to be there. And so the Good Place starts to go haywire when she arrives. So she has to learn to be a good person in order to avoid getting kicked out of the Good Place and getting sent to the Bad Place, which is this version of hell. Yeah, I really enjoyed this. I found this to be a really sharp show. It's from the creator of Parks and Rec, and it's aired the first two episodes so far. The third episode airs this Thursday. I thought it was very sharp. It was very funny. The show is building a really, really interesting world, and it's implying a lot of interesting questions about morality and about what it takes to get into the Good Place, and a whole bunch of different things. Kristen Bell is really great as the lead, who's kind of a variation of a Veronica Mars persona. I didn't watch Veronica Mars, but I've seen bits of it here and there, and it's kind of like the sarcastic, quippy kind of character. Who's very she's very self-absorbed in the show, obviously, because she's a bad person.
That's how you know.
And it's really funny, and it's really creative, and it's visually, there's just so much nuts stuff going on in the show. In the first episode, there's these gigantic ladybugs and gigantic shrimp that are attacking and destroying the Good Place.
That's amazing.
And this aired on NBC. It's like an NBC show.
Yeah.
NBC, I think this season has a lot of really promising shows. I think they're trying to get back to their reputation for quality, which they had for a very long time and then lost in the past couple of years and they canceled all their good shows. Yeah. but now they're getting the Good Place. They just premiered This Is Us, which I've heard is very good, which is the new show by Dan Fogelberg, who did – he wrote Crazy Stupid Love and he created Gallivant. And what was the other one? There's a new show called Timeless, which looks pretty cool, which looks like the show that I want Legends of Tomorrow to be.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think I have heard of this
one. You might have seen this one. It's from Sean Ryan, and Sean Ryan's the creator of The Shield,
right,
and Terriers and stuff like that. And it's also from the creator of Supernatural. And it's about like these three people who are just traveling to different time periods every episode to try to stop these thieves or whatever. It looks pretty cool. First episode, it's going to be the Hindenburg disaster. Looking forward to that. I think it looks pretty cool. But The Good Place is a really strong debut. I'm really excited to see where the show goes from here because it's such a weird concept that I don't know how long it could sustain a whole show for, but I'm really excited to see where it goes. I think Michael Shore, the creator of the show, has said that he basically wants to make a comedy version of Lost.
That's the best concept of all time.
I'm in. Like, that sounds great. That's really cool. And finally, I wanted to give a quick shout-out to Vice Principals, which ended its season on HBO this week. This is a really funny dark comedy from Jody Hill, who created Eastbound and Down, and also directed Observe and Report. This stars Danny McBride and Walton Goggins. This show has gone to some insane and horrifying places that most comedies would not dare go to. And it ends on a cliffhanger, which is completely bonkers. Can't wait to see season two, which is also going to be the show's last season. They planned it out from the beginning. So they shot 18 episodes in total all at once.
Right.
And split it down the middle, and they decided, like, that's it. Like, that's all they're doing. So season one, which was 9 episodes, has just finished. And season two, which will be another 9 episodes, will presumably air next year. And that's going to be it. That's the end of the show. So they have, like, a complete arc already in mind, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, that's really neat. I saw maybe 3 minutes of that show once. And I was like crying laughing. So I need to actually sit down and watch all of it.
Definitely check it out. Especially the first few episodes. A lot of it is just Danny McBride and Walton Goggins insulting each other.
Yeah, that's exactly what I saw.
And it's great. That's awesome. And Walton Goggins in particular, I'm so glad that he's on the show. I'm a big fan of him from Justified and Hateful Eight and stuff like that. And he has this like very weird presence, like in general. Like, I feel like whenever he's in something, like, it's just such a weird kind of performance that he gives, but it's always a really compelling one, and he's so good in everything that he does, and he's hilarious on the show. And Danny McBride's doing very good work too. He's doing kind of like a toned down version of his character from Eastbound and Down. Which is pretty cool. So very big fan of Vice Principals, very very much looking forward to season two. And the cliffhanger ending though was insane, man. Like, I if I had described it to you, I don't think you would believe me. So definitely check out Vice Principals when you can, and check out those other shows too if you can, because they're pretty good stuff too. That about wraps up our discussions, Mike.
Yeah, I think we're ready.
All right, let's do it. Let's go into the woods and check out our review of Blair Witch.
What is that?
The guy who uploaded this video said it was from a tape he found in the Black Hills woods. I think that might be my sister.
You really think your sister could still be out there after all these years?
If there is any chance that I could find out what happened to her, I need to try.
Legend said there's been a curse on these woods.
Do you believe in the stories about the Blair Witch?
All right, that was from the trailer for Blair Witch, the new film written by Simon Barrett and directed by Adam Wingard. The movie stars James Allen McCune, Callie Hernandez, Brandon Scott, Valerie Curie, Corbin Reed, and Wes Robinson. And it is, of course, the sequel to The Blair Witch Project, or should I say the second sequel to The Blair Witch Project, because there was a Blair Witch 2 in the year 2000 called Book of Shadows, Blair Witch 2. It's basically not a Blair Witch movie. It's not found footage, and it has almost nothing to do with the original movie. So this is the true sequel to The Blair Witch Project. And the IMDb plot synopsis reads, after discovering a video showing what he believes to be his vanished sister Heather, James and a group of friends head to the forest, believed to be inhabited by the Blair Witch.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. So, Mike, you're coming at this from an interesting perspective, because you have not seen The Blair Witch Project.
Correct.
And you have also not seen anything directed by Adam Wingard.
Correct.
So you're completely blind going into this.
Pretty much, yeah.
How did that feel going into you? Like, what were your expectations going in?
Well, I wasn't 100% positive. I didn't know that it was a direct sequel because I haven't seen any trailers or anything like that. I remember the big announcement that reveal at Comic-Con.
Right.
Where they were like, they pull their mask off and it's a Blair Witch movie. So I wasn't sure if it was going to be a reboot, which is kind of the trend now, or if it was going to be a direct sequel. So it was interesting to see right at the beginning of the movie, they set up that, you know, this character's sister was in the first one, and yeah, we're going to find out what happened. And it was kind of cool. I liked that they were sort of it was an interesting way to get around that question of, like, avoiding the it's just a reboot,
right,
but it was actually a sequel.
It's a continuation for sure. You know, I gotta say, I'm not a big fan of the Blair Witch Project. I've seen it once. I found it fairly boring, and I kind of dismissed it when I saw it as a product of its time. You know, the marketing for that movie was built around getting people to believe that the movie was real. You know, when it played at Sundance, and like people in the festival actually thought, like, wow, like this really happened. That's crazy. Like some people actually fell for it. And when you watch it, you can kind of see why, because it's not paced like a traditional horror movie. Most of the movie is just the kids in the woods,
right?
Without any crazy stuff happening until the very, very end.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they're getting like progressively more lost as they're going on, and they're getting more worried and stuff like that. But like, it's mostly just them wandering around the woods,
right,
and I found that pretty boring when I watched the Blair Witch Project. I might give it another shot in the near future sometime, but as of right now, I'm not a big fan of that movie. But even though I'm not a big fan of the Blair Witch Project, I am a big fan of director Adam Wingard, who was making this movie under the name The Woods before the big Comic-Con reveal this past year that it was, in fact, a Blair Witch movie. So
right.
Wingard directed Year Next and The Guest, which are two horror thriller films that I really love for their slick sense of humor, their creativity, and their total love of horror filmmaking. I mean, you got to see The Guest, Mike, because the climax of The Guest is one of the like most film-geekiest sequences I have ever seen. It is awesome.
Now, I have a question for you. Is Adam Wingard and the writer of this, are they a duo? Like, have they made all their movies together?
Yes, okay. Simon Barrett, who wrote this movie, also wrote Year Next and The Guest. And they've both made movies together outside of those, but those are the big ones. I've only seen Year Next and The Guest, and I've seen their segments on the VHS movies, which they've also done. But they've done other stuff that hasn't gotten as much press or as much acclaim. I've been meaning to go into that back catalog for a long time. I just haven't got around to it. Blair Witch, I think, sees Wingard and Barrett doing a very different kind of horror film than Year Next and The Guest. You know, he kind of has to adhere to the style of the Blair Witch Project.
Right.
And that means losing a lot of the jokey dialogue that he has in his movies and adopting found footage, which is something he messed around with directing shorts for the first two VHS movies. But those were, you know, 5-10 minute shorts. They're nothing like super substantial. This is an entire movie. And so it's it's a different kind of different beast altogether. And I will say, Blair Witch has not been getting the critical acclaim that Wingard's other movies have been getting. I don't know if you saw any of the reviews for Blair Witch.
No, I haven't.
It holds a 30-something in Rotten Tomatoes right now.
Wow.
And it very much underperformed at the box office. It made its budget. It was made for like $5 million.
Right.
But it didn't do as well as I think the studio hoped, you know, because the Blair Witch is such a huge like name recognition. You would think more people would go see this movie.
Yeah. That's something I was going to talk about too. Was, you know, I've never seen the Blair Witch, but it's one of those cultural osmosis things where that was such a big deal when that came out,
right?
That it's kind of impossible not to know about it or know what the movie's about and all that stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, this movie hasn't gotten the critical acclaim that I think people were hoping it would get, or Wingard was hoping it would get. And Adam Wingard actually got into a little bit of trouble online for what I thought was a pretty clearly joking tweet. you know, but writer Simon Barrett was on Twitter, and he wrote a tweet that I thought was very funny, which was, well, our horror film may have been a disappointment at the box office this weekend, but at least we got overwhelmingly negative reviews.
That's amazing.
Which I thought was pretty funny and, like, you know, a nice way to kind of, like, yeah, you know, take it in stride, whatever. To which Adam Wingard replied to him and said, bro, I told you we should have made the movie about the boring guy who landed a plane in water instead. And people got very upset about that tweet.
Really?
Yeah. Caused a little controversy because I people look at Sully as a hero, man.
I guess, sure.
Yeah, you call him boring. But I mean, he apologized for it and everything. But again, I thought it was a pretty funny tweet. I thought it was pretty good. And now is the part where I say, I really enjoyed Blair Witch. I thought it was a very solid horror movie with some creative sequences, some fun scares. You know, Wingard doesn't really make scary horror movies. He makes fun ones, you know, right. And I don't think Blair Witch is as good as his previous two movies, but I had a very good time with it. Mike, what did you think?
Yeah, for the most part, I thought it was pretty all right. I wasn't don't have a negative opinion of it. I wasn't blown away by anything. And that said, I mean, we've talked about it before, my distaste for found footage movies.
Yes.
And they managed to avoid all of that for the most part.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, there's still the camera pointing at the feet thing, which, whatever. But I had talked about it when we had decided to do this movie as a review, that modern technology allows the found footage movies to avoid the traps of found footage. Like, found footage is I totally understand it's a way to make a low-budget, cheap, quick movie.
Yes.
Which is great for indie filmmakers and stuff, but then it falls into the, like, we make the joke, you have to justify why they're holding a camera the whole time.
Yes, I'm pretty sure there's a line of dialogue in the Blair Witch Project where they say that people deserve to know. I'm pretty sure that's where it comes from.
That's where the joke is from?
I think so.
That's probably true. But you know, in cameras were huge, they were bulky, and now this movie, they literally are Bluetooth earpieces that have a camera in them.
Yes. Yeah, this movie, you know, I like the found footage aspect a lot in this movie because it uses a variety of different cameras, including, you know, the earpieces and a drone, which I thought, you know, gave the movie a lot more variety in terms of the shots it can get. Because the original movie, it's been a while since I've seen it. I'm pretty sure it's just the one camera that they're using the entire time.
Right.
And that's part of why that movie gets old after a while. You know,
yeah.
Again, that movie is mostly just people wandering around the woods for a while. And if I taped me and my friends walking around the woods for an hour and a half, it wouldn't be that interesting. You know?
Yeah. So they do have a variety of cameras. They have the you know, the night vision camera set up on the tree. They have the drone. They even have a sort of homage to the original one with the guy who prefers the low tech camera. So he has the big bulky tape camera. Which I thought was neat. It, like you said, it adds to a lot of variety. They have, like, at any given time, four or five shots to shoot, like, that they can bounce around from because they've justified that everyone has a camera. But without making it hokey. So I was able to, you know, look past all that. And especially now, it doesn't look like it's filmed on a VHS tape.
That is good, too.
It's filmed at regular theatrical quality, which is nice.
Yeah. I mean, it does help eliminate the question of why would the characters still be holding the camera when they're being attacked and running for their lives. I think it raises another question, which is, who's editing all this footage together? You know, who's going into these woods, finding every single one of these cameras? And there's a lot. You know, there's the one on the drone. There's earpieces on everybody. There's cameras on the flashlights. And there's the old camera. And all this stuff. And somehow made it back out of the woods alive without being attacked by the Blair Witch.
Yeah, you said it's been a long time since you've seen the first one. I haven't seen it. So I don't know what the, you know, how they justify that. And this is part of my issue with found footage films is that, you know, even movies that start with the title card, the following events are based on a true story, they don't expect you to believe you're watching them happen for real.
Right.
But however, found footage movies, that's the whole, we found this camera and this was the footage on it.
Yes.
So like when shit gets weird, that doesn't, like, how does that camera get found? That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, that's part of why I liked The Visit so much, because remember we watched The Visit and like the main character was a documentary filmmaker, so it gave her a reason to be or like she, maybe not a documentary, she was like a young girl with a camera.
She wanted to be a documentary
filmmaker. Wanted to be a documentary filmmaker, and she was filming throughout the whole movie. You see why she's filming the movie. Right. And you also just watch her editing the movie. During the movie.
Right.
So it even makes the excuse for why the movie's all edited together so nice. Like,
yeah, exactly.
But again, that's a minor complaint. That's just like a thing that's like obviously it's a horror movie. Like it doesn't, it's,
yeah, it's not really a big deal.
Yeah. I know it's fake, so I know it's, right. You know, but it's fun to think about. I do think this movie's a lot better paced than The Blair Witch Project, which again, that movie's a very slow burn. Until it gets to anything, you know, worthwhile in the last couple minutes. I think this movie is still kind of a slow burn at first.
Yes.
You know, it is a lot of wandering around in the woods, but I think things start to go south very quickly once they do. I would probably run the halfway mark, I would say. And then you're also given more characters in this movie to kind of bounce off of, because the original is just three characters.
Oh, okay.
And the dynamics between them, again, you're just watching them wander around the woods for an hour and a half, and I feel like the dynamic between them gets very stale. After a while. In this movie, there's different combinations of different characters that you can bounce off of, and I think it helps this movie out quite a bit.
Yeah, and I definitely applaud this movie, too, for being just under 90 minutes. I think it's like 88 or something like that.
Right.
Which, compared to something like The Conjuring 2, which was 2.5 hours. I was a little nervous that this movie was going to be like that, but then, when I sat down before the trailers, I checked online and was like, okay.
I was going to say, you don't look up the run times before you go in? Because I always, like, make sure I know the runtime way ahead of time, so I know what I'm just so I know what I'm getting into. You know,
I do most of the time, but so that was it. I think it definitely benefits from being that, and that, you know, that it can, we get, you know, the typical 20 minutes of normal stuff, and then 20 minutes of weirdness things starting, and then we just go straight to horror climax for the rest of the movie.
And it's kind of it's a pretty insane climax too. I think it's you know, it's pretty bonkers. You never do get a good look at the Blair Witch or whatever it is, which I think definitely helps the mystique of the movie, the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And it is essentially a remake of the original movie,
right?
Which again, you haven't seen, so maybe I didn't you didn't feel that as much.
For the most part, like I had said, the cultural osmosis thing. I feel like I've seen the Blair Witch Project, even though I haven't. I was able to recognize that it's basically a remake.
Right. I mean, that kind of makes it. I was thinking about this a few weeks ago, actually. It kind of makes it the latest movie in what I'm going to call the remixes, which are what I'm going to call remakes that are disguised as sequels.
Interesting.
Because this is a sequel to the original movie, but it's also kind of a remake, much like Star Wars The Force Awakens, which is a remake of A New Hope, Creed, which is a remake of Rocky, Terminator Genesis, which is a remake of the first two Terminator movies, Star Trek Into Darkness, which is a remake of Wrath of Khan. You know, this is like a weird thing that's been happening lately. And some movies have done it very well, some movies have done it not so well. Terminator Genesis, I'm looking at you. But I think this movie does it pretty well. I think it's, and I do think it's superior to the Blair Witch Project, which again is a movie I didn't like that much. So your mileage may vary. It almost feels like this is the Blair Witch movie for people who don't like the Blair Witch Project, which might be why it's gotten negative reviews so far.
Yeah, that's fair. it also feels like too. I mean, it's been what, 17 years? When did Blair Witch came out?
99 was when it came out. 99 about that time, yeah.
And I don't know. I mean, I guess it's not. It feels like Blair Witch Project was, like, aimed at being a cult movie, but somehow blew up into this whole big thing.
Sure.
So it's interesting to see, because we always talk about the, like, we're getting a reboot or a sequel, but, like, we just had the other one. We don't need it again. And this kind of feels like a movie we didn't need or no one asked for.
Right.
A remix of, like, I'll use your term. yet I think it succeeded for the most part. It updates the found footage and all that stuff to new technology, which is what you hope remakes do. They actually bring something new to the table, and this one definitely does.
Yeah, absolutely.
So like we both said, we had positive experiences with it. Yeah, I think you liked it a little bit more than I did.
I would say so. Yeah, I would think so as well. I don't know. Anything else? Should we get into spoilers, Mike?
I think we should do spoilers.
All right, let's get into spoilers for Blair Witch starting right now.
Stop it! Stop it! Stop it! Both of you! spoiling it. You're spoiling everything.
All right. It's time for spoilers for Blair Witch starting right now. So I thought the climax was really, really good. I thought the third act was pretty bonkers. Which I really enjoyed. And that's something that Adam Wingard's movies tend to do, is they get progressively more bonkers as they go along, to use the technical term.
Yes.
And, you know, I like the way James is kind of – James, I guess, would kind of be the protagonist of this movie if we had to pick one. But it kind of shifts protagonist to Lisa in the last few minutes of the movie and kind of has her be the last person you end up seeing and being with.
Yeah.
I thought that worked very well. I thought Lisa was a good person to follow for those last few minutes. It reminded me of Your Next, actually, which has a very kick-ass female protagonist. And it almost made me think, like, oh, this is when Lisa becomes a badass or something.
Right.
Turned out that wasn't exactly the case. But she did manage to survive for quite a while, you know.
Yeah.
I was almost convinced she would make it out alive. I thought she might.
Yeah, it's interesting to have a very similar thought process. But having you say that, was it Your Next or The Guest that has the most film geekiest sequence in it?
The very end of The Guest.
Yeah. This felt very much, the end of this movie felt very much like that, where it was like, here's all the horror tropes all of a sudden, but in a love letter kind of way.
Yeah, exactly.
Where we have the final girl who's going to survive. And suddenly she figures out all – she remembers all the shit that you would think, like, you know, she's super smart. And all of a sudden she figures everything out and she's going to make it.
Yep.
But then in a homage to the original Blair Witch, I think, that doesn't work out so well.
It does not. It does not. Also, what I thought was interesting in this movie, and maybe this was in the Blair Witch Project, I haven't seen it in a long time, so it's been a while. The Blair Witch has the ability to mess with time.
Yeah.
As we see with Lane, after he and his girlfriend separate from the group, he tells them that he's been gone for 6 days. When to them, it's only been a few hours. And that moment was like, whoa. Like, I thought that was pretty cool.
That was really neat.
And then when he reappears in the house, it looks like he's been there for years.
Yeah, you know? His hair is long. He's got a huge beard.
Yeah, and he says to Lisa, like, you look exactly like I remember.
Right.
You know, he's acting crazy, and that's nuts. So I thought that was a pretty interesting touch. And again, I don't know if that's something that was in the original movie, because it has been a little while since I've seen it. I do think in the original movie, the perpetual darkness thing does happen.
Oh, okay. That was really, I thought that moment, because they make camp for the first night and they wake up and they're looking at their clits, 2 p.m., how did we sleep so long? And like,
right.
Oh, there's weird stuff going on in the woods.
Yeah,
and
that definitely happens in the Blair Witch Project, where they sleep till a ridiculous hour or something.
Yeah. Which I thought was really interesting. And I do, it adds to that slow burn part of the first two acts, I think.
Yes.
Where it starts ramping up stakes, but not, and they pay off. I think they do pay off in a really good way, like you said, when they show back up and to them.
Right, when the things when the stick figure things reappear.
Oh, man. Yeah, I was going to get to there, yeah. but I was going to say with that moment when Lane reveals that to them it's been 6 days, but for the other group it's been a couple hours.
Yes.
And I feel like there's a couple, like, just tossed out lines. In that moment he says, before he says it's been 6 days, he says something like, the sun hasn't come up.
Right.
And so you're like, wait, what? That's weird. And then he's like, it's been 6 days, and it's like, oh, what? And and then we get the, you know, it sets up a lot of cool stuff, I guess is what
it
I'm
does.
Saying.
It very much does. And part of what I liked is that, you know, the stick figures show up the first time, and it turns out to just be Lane and his girlfriend making them to try to keep them in the woods.
That was the part I was confused about. Were they trying to scare them all into leaving or to keep them to stay?
I believe it was to keep them to stay. Okay. Although now that I'm thinking about it, like, obviously they're going to leave when they saw those.
Yeah, I think he says I don't remember exactly what the line was, but it's something a lot like, because afterwards they decide to split up and he says, you guys want this to happen, we're out of here. So him and his girlfriend leave, but I think he had used the stick figures as a way to motivate them all to leave.
Oh, maybe. I mean, that's kind of weird because he was the one who wanted to be there in the first place.
Yeah, I don't remember. I think things escalate in some weird way for them.
Okay.
But I think it works with the, you know, the whole legend of the Blair Witch that he messes with everyone's minds and stuff.
That's possible, yeah. I mean, that is a little unclear, I guess. But when the stick figures reappear and it's not Lane's work this time, and it's very clearly not their work this time because there's a lot more of them, and they're much bigger and, you know, more intricately crafted, you know, that was, I thought, a very effective reveal. And then, I thought every death scene in this movie was pretty well executed.
Yeah.
But especially Talia's death, Lane's girlfriend.
Oh, yeah. That was the big one.
After the stick figures reappear in the campsite, Talia, like, Italia, who has just been stuck in the woods for 6 days while it's just been like a couple hours for them, right. Is going insane, just going crazy, and she notices that one of them appears to be made with her own hair.
Right.
And then Ashley, who's very sick at this point and acting crazy also, takes it and snaps it, and then that causes Talia's body to like fold in on itself and get ripped apart, basically, which I thought was a very effective death. I liked that one a lot.
Yeah, that was a really cool way to indicate that we are at the climax.
This is like nuts time now.
Because it's weird enough that it's made, like, held together with her hair, I think, is something like that. Like, it's, you know, her hair is used to wrap the sticks together. Like, that's creepy enough. And then we move on to, nope, she's broken in half now.
And then I did kind of laugh every time that Ashley got hurt. I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, it happened at first, and it was like, oh, her foot got cut open. That's sad. And then, like, a few minutes later, like, you just hear a cracking sound. It's like, and then it's almost, like, hilarious, like, how many times that happens.
Yeah. Right. Well, it was interesting, too, because they set her up to sort of be the, like, Ditzy's not the word, like, city girl kind of thing. Like, they take their shoes off to cross the river, and she's like, joke at her that she got a pedicure before coming into the woods, and then she like cuts her foot, and you're like, oh, of course she'd like, she just doesn't know what she's doing, she's not an outdoors person.
Right.
And it's silly, like, it starts off in a silly joke that, like, every she keeps getting hurt, like, all this stuff, which I agree, I did laugh at when she gets hurt the second time,
because
it sounds like a bone snapping or something weird.
Yeah, and then, you know, she's getting progressively more sick, because her wound is reopened up, and then there's the moment where her boyfriend takes off her shoe, and starts to examine the wound, and you see something try to poke out of the wound, and it's, like, a really quick thing, but it's, like, a quick jump. And it made me laugh. Like, it was kind of like a fun kind of jump.
Yeah.
Like, oh shit, there it comes. But
And his reaction to it is very, very funny.
It was very, Roy Scheider in Jaws when he sees the shark on the boat.
That's exactly what it is. Yeah. That's exactly what it is. And even though like you said this, because they're beholden to the Blair Witch style, they can't make the jokey comedy, like, it can't be a horror comedy type thing,
right? And I mean, like, I wouldn't classify Wingard's movies as horror comedies, but they're definitely jokey-ish. Like, I feel like there's right. there's this sense of fun about them, especially Your Next has a lot of jokes in it, so that would be pretty close to a horror comedy. I'm gonna say my favorite moment in Your Next, that's okay, because it's really funny. There's this basically Your Next is a home invasion movie, so it's like these family having dinner, and suddenly like these mass men with arrows are just shooting into their house, and one of the arrows hits a guy in the back. And you know, the family like runs out into the foyer, tries to get in the foyer, gets in there, and then they decide somebody should run out to try to get help.
Right.
And you know, they're asking around like, okay, who's the fastest? And the guy with the arrow in his back shouts at them, I'm the fastest, but I have an arrow in my back.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's a good movie. It's very, you should definitely check it out. It's very funny. Very fun movie.
Yeah, speaking of that kind of thing, you know, or at least being aware of tropes and horror devices and stuff, there's a segment that was, I thought, a pretty decent joke where it's when Peter or James goes to look for Peter, and we're left with Lisa in the campsite, and the use of the night vision camera I thought was really cool.
Right.
Like mounted in the tree, where it leaves a lot of dark negative space where you're expecting a lot of stuff.
Yeah, like that. There was definitely one moment where I think I saw something moving.
Maybe. I don't know. I was again, definitely like looking for it.
Yeah. But it's hard to
tell. But then a lot of times and because the characters are all wearing the head-mounted cameras that, like, people come in into extreme close-ups because it's, like, people running up to each other. So they use that for jump scares, and they do it, like, two or three times in a row during that segment. And at the like after the third time, Lisa, you hear her just like, Jesus, people need to stop doing that. Like, like they make a joke out of how they keep using jump scares.
Yeah, that did remind me of Your Next, actually. That felt like a very that was a pretty good joke.
Yeah, so they managed to work that stuff in there, which is nice considering the stakes of what's going on.
Right. Yeah. So what did you think of the ending of this movie? Like the very end.
The in the house, that whole segment.
Yes.
Really effective. I was super creeped out. Definitely a bunch of watching through my eyes for a couple moments
Yeah, like I like the way foreshadows Lisa's death with James's death just a moment earlier. Each one thinks they hear the voice of someone who just died, right. or in James's case, died many years ago. You know, and you know, because they're like, James figures out, like, if you don't look at the Blair Witch, it can't hurt you.
Right.
Right. That's that.
We're told that earlier as part of the legend.
Right. And so you're just staring directly in the corner and, you know, terrified out of their minds. And then the Blair Witch uses Heather's voice from the first movie, James's sister, to lure him into the trap. And he, like, looks back and he immediately dies. Like, he immediately gets attacked.
Yeah.
And you don't actually hear Heather's voice. You just hear James saying, "Heather, is that you?" And Lisa's like, "What? What are you talking about? What's going on?" And then James dies. And so at that point, it's just Lisa. And she's, again, doing the badass, like, I might be able to make it out of this alive thing, where she's able to use her camera's mirror to kind of get her way out of the house.
Yeah, the little viewfinder thing.
Yeah, she's using the camera to get the reflection so she doesn't have to look directly at the Blair Witch. Then the Blair Witch does the exact same thing to her.
And we hear James's voice.
We hear James's voice this time, and she hears, and she's like, "James, you're alive!" And then turns around, and she dies.
Yeah. yeah, which was pretty cool. I thought that was a interesting way to do that. They set up a couple moments earlier when she's crawling through the tunnels with the, you know, they make effective use of the weird of the cameras and stuff. I thought in that sequence where she keeps throwing it in front of her and we get the camera like.
Yes, yeah, I thought so
get
too.
Get to see her crawling towards the camera, which was creepy as shit in the super claustrophobic tunnel filled with water.
Yes, and I like that there's a camera attached to the flashlight as well. Again, just every possible reason to not have them holding a camera. Because obviously they want to hold a flashlight. That makes sense.
That makes sense,
so
yeah.
Why not attach a camera to the flashlight?
Yeah, that actually sort of reminded me of, oh man, I can't remember that movie. Came out, I think, a year or two ago about the Storm Chasers.
Was it called The Storm Chasers?
No. It might have been, honestly.
Was it Into the Storm?
Yes, I think it was. It's just about, like, a massive tornado or something.
Right, with the wife from The Walking Dead?
Yeah, that movie. Which makes huge use of GoPros, where, like, their whole car is mounted in GoPros.
Okay.
Because it's like, you know, tank meant to drive into a tornado, so they have cameras all over it.
Right.
Which I think is a clever use of modern technology to alleviate the issue of the whole shtick.
Yeah.
So like you said, just ignoring reason and just put cameras on everything, because that's, like, it makes more sense that way for a movie.
Exactly, yeah. More cameras, the better.
Yeah.
Is basically what we're coming to the conclusion here. And yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I got any more thoughts on Blair Witch. Mike, do you have anything else you want to say?
Not particularly. I think that the last shot was kind of cool. I think that's sort of from what I've seen the last shot of the original Blair Witch.
Right.
Where whoever's holding the camera gets, like, smacked or something. They fall and they drop the camera and it's just pointing at the guy standing in the corner.
Right.
You know, fades to black. This doesn't have that exact thing, but
right. You do see the guy standing in a corner earlier in the movie.
Yeah, we see Peter standing in the corner.
Was that Peter? That was.
I think so, or at least I believed it was, because that's James opens the door with lightning, whatever. Lightning flashes, and there's someone in the corner.
That's what it is.
He says, "Peter, is that you?" And then the door slams. And he turns around, and he's gone. So I don't know if it's actually him, but it made me curious about the first one, because that's the only thing I really know about the first Blair Witch Project like, stand in the corner and it's creepy.
yeah. Well, now that you're saying it, I mean, he says, "Peter's that you?" So maybe it was Peter.
Right.
And he looked back at him, and once he looked back, the Blair Witch got him.
Yeah. Maybe.
And that's,
that could,
like,
be it.
Sort of subtle foreshadowing for later on in the movie when James and Lisa die.
Right.
Yeah. That's pretty clever. That's
good. Yeah. So there's some interesting stuff there where, you know, a lot of it gets paid off. The perpetual night, when we're told the first legend, the legend of the guy who brought the kids into his house to kill them, which, like, in the '40s or something like that.
Right.
We're told there were tunnels that go to nowhere.
Right.
There's some discrepancy between it's the basement or the attic, and we go to both of those places in the house. Like, there's a lot of setup and payoff for weird, creepy things that I did enjoy, and I guess that's kind of really it. It's a good creepy horror movie for the most part.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. Again, I don't think it's as good as Your Next of the Guest, which I think are two of the best horror movies of the last several years. So, you know, it probably wasn't going to be as good as those movies anyway, but it's still a very, very good time. I liked it a lot.
Yeah.
And that about wraps up our Blair Witch discussion, Mike. So where can we find you online this week?
You can find me at twitter.com/mdfilmblog. And if you like Dungeons & Dragons, my friends and I post our games at youtube.com/geonerd79.
And you can find me at twitter.com/emmasmithfilmblog and all my podcasts and filmbook.com. Thank you so much for listening to the complete to Film Bookcast. I'm Mike Smith, and that's Mike's Pre-Show. If you're listening to this video via our podcast on iTunes, please subscribe to the podcast, rate it, and take a moment to give us a review. Any and all feedback, compliments, topic discussions, and even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Please list the podcast you're emailing about in the title of your email. We produce so many different ones, hard to keep track. We would love to hear from you. And if you want to donate to Film Book's Patreon campaign, go to patreon.com/filmbook for all your Patreoning needs. Join us in 2 weeks where we're going to be discussing The Magnificent Seven. Is that good by you, Mike?
That's a sentence I can approve.
All right, cool. So Magnificent Seven in 2 weeks, and then you can check out our next complete works where we're going to be discussing Cage's Oscar-winning role in Leaving Las Vegas. Are you excited for that one, Mike?
I am. I'm excited for a good Nicolas Cage movie.
Hey, man.
We've had some good ones.
We have had some good ones. We've had some bad ones. But we've had some good ones. Most recently, Kiss of Death, which I did enjoy. All right, thank you so much for listening, guys. We are out.
Ladies and gentlemen, the pilot has turned on the get down sign. Buckle up tight, cause it's a real short flight. Give your mustache a brush from the left to the right. A gaggle of geese just surrender their souls. Drop your mustache twice and grab the controls. Brakes for impact, the plane ain't gonna taxi. Make sure your mustache is not.
John.
Just hold on a second. Just let me get this straight. Buckle tight, left to right, gaggle, gaggle, mustache, twice, brace and taxi, mustache, taxi, bring it up, mustache, oh,
big finish. Everybody's talking about Sully, Sully. Everybody's talking about Sully.
Yeah.